Welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of Strong Tower Radio, West Central Michigan Media Ministries, or its employees.
Hello, folks. Welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today, the Good Growing with the Garden Guy edition for April. And we have Gary Heilig, our expert from the Extension Service. He's a retired agent, but that gives him more time to do this program. Welcome, Gary.
Sort of retired.
I know Gary, he's got his hands in many good things. He just redirected himself, just not getting paid as much. Hey, and also,
I don't need any money, Tom.
Okay, good. You've been a good steward all your life, as well as steward of the ground. And my co-host again this month for the fourth straight month is my dear sister, Sue Majeure. Welcome back, Sue.
It's good to be here.
And I call her the armchair gardener because she does all the reading and I do all the work.
At midnight,
that's right. There's a story behind that, but we won't go there right now. Well, folks, this is the April issue, and we'd like to get started with a word of prayer. Our great Heavenly Father, such a blessing to get out, and at this time of year, the temperatures are moderating, and maybe the frost is starting to leave the ground, and we're starting that preparation. And Lord, what a joy, the happy time of the year. The sunlight is over half the day. And so, dear Lord, we want to start this gardening season to dedicate it to you and the joys of communing with you and our family and the nutrition that we gain from our food and the joy from the plants that we plant. We thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.
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 Well, Sue, throw the curveball at Gary.
Okay, well, here's something that maybe people don't think about when they're thinking about gardening. Let's say that you say, I'm tired of living in this little apartment or cheese box, and we're finally ready to have our own little piece of land with a house on it.
So the first house, huh?
So you're looking, or the house is too big, you need to downsize, or the house is too little and you need more room.
You just need a house.
You just need a different house. And you thinking you want to have room for a garden too. But even if you're not an avid gardener, you still have to think about that property that you're on. What are subtle clues that the real estate agent may not be thinking or telling you about when you look at that?
The very first thing that I want to know is the topsoil still there?
Okay.
Because in a lot of subdivisions, what they do is they push the topsoil off to the side, sell it to somebody else, and you're left with the subsoil.
Or they didn't put it back appropriately or correctly.
Yeah.
Let me even weigh in on that. When we moved to Lansing, my sister totally is shaking her head. The soil was absolutely abominable. You couldn't grow anything because this topsoil was removed. Mm-hmm. And we put sod in the backyard.
Oh, hours of rolling out that sod. And then Dad tried to seed the front yard, and it just, oh, it was terrible. Mostly crabgrass.
And it
just couldn't do it.
And it eroded because it didn't grow. And the backyard, the sod, after a couple of years, kind of died out because there wasn't any topsoil to go below the soil that was with it. So take it away. We feel your pain.
Yeah, well, I didn't have that problem. But
okay.
Anyway, but the other thing that you have to realize is many times when they do sell the topsoil, especially if it's new construction, the people that do the construction are there year-round, and they will compact what's left of the soil, which is usually clay subsoil, and it makes it impossible to grow much of anything. And for decades after that, you'll have problems with trees and shrubs and things like that. So you want to know what the state of the situation is before you buy the house.
So this is part of the checklist of buying a house.
Mm-hmm.
or even renting a house.
Yeah.
If you're renting a house and you want a garden, do you want this to be a part of your factor?
Also realize that if you buy a house, for instance, in an established neighborhood, and you have trees that go over onto your neighbor's property, that part of the tree belongs to your neighbor. So it might be a beautiful tree, and they might one day decide to just slice it all straight up and ruin the overall look of the tree. They have the right to do that if it's over onto their property.
Well, what if that tree that even the trunk is on your side of the thing and the limbs fall off and hit their house, do you have some liability even though it's hanging over their side?
If you knew that there's that possibility because there was a problem with the tree, yes, it could be a problem for you.
Okay.
So, and if you have something like that on your property, a tree that's hanging over your own house and it has, say, rotting inside the trunk, and you know that, and it falls on your house, they may try to get out of paying for it. So another thing I would look at is if you have large trees on the property, you want to know what kind of trees are they. For instance, when we had the problem with emerald ash borer,
yes,
people would buy homes that had lots of beautiful ashes on them, which I pretty much told them within the next few years they're all going to be dead, and it costs a lot of money to take down a big tree.
So you need to call in your arborist before you buy a house?
It's a good idea to know what's on the property.
Because if you don't know and something is going to have to be taken out later, it may be a bill of thousands of dollars that you just weren't prepared for.
Or you may have some trees that are growing under power lines that look nice. Well, the power company can come in there and whack those back too, and that can make the trees look bad that you might want to just cut them down.
In fact, it's been my observation, the power companies have been more aggressive about trimming back these trees because of power outages, mm-hmm. and so saves them a problem during an emergency, windstorms and power outages, which everybody gets mm-hmm. unhappy about. But they're cutting back more of these trees, mm-hmm. so expect it.
And also, as we were talking beforehand, you can tell, for instance, if you have certain problems in your yard by looking around at the plants that are growing there. For instance, if you have nutsedge growing in the grass.
What is that?
Nutsedge is it's sort of like a grass-like plant, but the stem is triangular on it.
Okay.
It's not very tall. It only gets to be about 8 or 9 inches tall. And that can indicate that the soil is very wet.
Okay.
So if you had flooding or something in the spring, that's an indication that that could be a problem. So
I think Sue's got a story to that.
Somebody was telling me they were like a botanist and they were looking for a house. And he asked the real estate agent, he says, does this yard flood in the spring? No, he says. And he says, I knew that couldn't be true because the plants growing there only grow in moist, wet conditions.
Yeah. And so in this case, you couldn't really trust the realtor. And also, if you're out in the country and you happen to have a septic tank and drain field, you want to be sure that there aren't plants growing nearby because the roots can get into the drain field and cause all kinds of problems.
What kind of plant? I mean, grass doesn't hurt.
No, grass is okay.
Like bushes?
We're talking about shrubs and trees, especially trees.
Or even wild plants and so on and so forth.
Yeah, it's large plants that send out their roots a good distance. They will look for those nutrients from the drain field, and then they will send the roots right into the holes in the drain field and clog it up.
Like Japanese honeysuckle or some other invasive annoyance?
You don't really want any kind of shrub or tree near or on your drain field.
So just, I'm thinking, you're buying the property and you're with the real estate agent. How do you find out where that drain field is?
Well, you need to know that because you're going to have that bad boy pumped, the septic tank. And if you're not caring for the septic tank, then eventually the effluent in the septic tank will go into the drain field and clog it up and ruin it. And then that's about $20,000 bill that you're going to have to.
You can request that of the plat maps and other maps that show. And also, if it's out in the country, usually before sale, they have to do a well and septic.
Yeah.
Inspection.
Yeah,
but you've usually bought it by that time, right?
No, you can request it before, you know, making contingent upon in the purchase agreement.
And you may want to have the water tested, too, if you have a well.
Mm-hmm. Well and septic.
Test the water.
Now, there are different things you can test the well for. Normally, they're testing for bacteria content, for instance, to make sure that the septic field hasn't failed and contaminating your water source. For instance, where I live, my well is 150 feet deep, so that's not likely to be a problem. It's more of a problem on a shallow well, 50 feet or 70 feet or something like that. But if you're around an agricultural industry, there are certain products that could get into the drinking water, and you may want to have it tested for atrazine-type herbicides, that type of thing.
Is there, if you, let's say you buy an older establishment.
They're called triazine herbicides.
you have an older established property with a lot of big trees on it. And let's say they're not near the line, so you're not worried about the power company. But you're thinking, I wonder if these trees are healthy or if there's some kind of limbs that might fall on my house or something. Is it cost effective or worthwhile to have like an arborist or somebody out to just kind of give it a quick check?
From a standpoint of the damage you could suffer, yeah, it certainly is.
Now, let me ask you this question. What is an arborist?
An arborist is a person who's certified that knows about trees and how to care for them.
Is there certification for an arborist? Or
yeah, there are different certifications people can get. Yeah.
And where do
and
you
when
find
you,
them?
When you look in the yellow pages, it'll say certified arborist on staff.
Okay.
I mean, you just can't call yourself an arborist.
Okay.
There's a certain amount of training you have to go through.
Is it worthwhile if you have older trees, especially if they're beautiful and you want to preserve them, one of the reasons you may have bought the property, to have a lightning cord put on them?
Lightning rod on the tree?
No. In the 34 years that I worked for Extension, I only went out to three different houses where lightning had struck a tree. I mean, and one of them was out. Of course, it was going to get struck because it was the highest thing in the area. It's a big oak tree, and there was just nothing that tall. But another one was right next to a house in among other trees, and then a third one was in a backyard. But it's so rare that I wouldn't waste my time.
You know, how far does a fall tree, if you look at just sizing it up, how do you tell a tree that is at risk to your house that you may be considering buying or renting? Is it just like you say, kind of like it tips over and...
Well, the lean of the tree can make a difference. Whether or not the trunk and the branches are solid and they don't show evidence of, say, carpenter ant infestation or any type of internal wood rot, the species of the tree will make a difference too, because an oak is less likely to fall than a silver maple, which is what we call a soft maple, and its wood is much softer and more likely to break. So the species, what shape the tree is in, also the angle of the branches. For instance, if you have a branch angle that's fairly narrow, in other words, it's more toward the vertical, toward the main trunk, that's a weaker branch angle than one that's almost 90 degrees of the main trunk. 90 degrees is about as strong as you can get.
I would think that that would have more snow load and be more likely to fall off.
Which one? The one that's
the
wide?
The horizontal.
No. That's the wood itself, when you come to the trunk, it's not occluded. It's not compressed at all. So it's stronger wood.
You learned it here on the Good Growing Show. A couple things is... I think we have a sugar maple. I don't know. What is the species of sugar? Is it actually a species called sugar maple? Now, do those ones tend to tip over?
No, sugar maple is what we call a hard maple.
Okay.
So it's going to last better than, say, a Norway or, as I mentioned before, the, what was the other maple I just mentioned?
Silver.
Silver maple. I haven't seen your moment there. A sugar maple is a pretty solid tree.
Well, I feel good. I've got five of them around my house, so two of them are in close proximity.
But it is susceptible to a soil-borne fungal disease called verticillium, and you can have branches die. And, of course, once a branch dies, it's only a matter of time before it breaks down to the point to where it can fall.
Very good. We're almost becoming a vocabulary source here. So after this, we're going to have a quiz of how many vocabulary. We've got arborist, and I've got, you mentioned a word about when you're talking about the septics and the drain fields, you talked about affluence. Now, is that anything we want to talk about? Affluence? Well, is that anything we want to talk about?
And it sounds like a polite term for overflow.
It really is. But
not a nice overflow.
I'm surprised at how many people have no idea how their septic system works.
Okay.
And even though I was a horticulturist, I got questions on this because.
Well, you know.
We got questions on it.
Well, let me verify that is early winter was the first time I ever pumped my septic tank. And first I had to find it. I had to find the lid. And then I got an education in it. And I'm still learning about the drain field. So we're all ears, those of us who live in the country.
So the way this works is when you flush the toilet.
Okay.
The waste goes into the septic tank.
Okay.
Inside the septic tank.
That's usually a cavity. It used to be cement.
It is cement. And there might be some other things that they're using now, but they could be 500 to 1,000 gallons. And so once the waste goes in there, there are a whole host of bacteria, what we call anaerobic bacteria, which don't need oxygen in order to carry out their breaking down of organic matter. And they give off a specific smell, sulfur dioxide, when you open it up.
You
Not
smell
very
it.
Pleasant smell, but anyway, you learn to live with it. So it breaks down
the
all
the joys
that,
of living in the country, right?
Yeah. It breaks down all those materials. And then the liquid portion of the waste will go into the drain field because there's more liquid going in.
It's on the top, right?
Right. It's on the top. And
it's lighter. It doesn't have suspended.
Right. And it starts to move out into a series of tubes with holes in it. They're actually pipes. And those pipes allow the liquid portion of the waste to seep out into the surrounding soil. Then as that happens, it goes down through the soil profile. And as it does that, it's being filtered. Any material that's not liquid will get filtered out. Hopefully there's not much of that because you don't want that clogging up your drain field. And bacteria, viruses, everything is filtered out. So by the time the water gets down to
the water table,
and it can be quite deep, then it's pretty much cleaned.
So how many, this is a question I always wanted to ask. How far does, in that drain field, how deep does that water flow from that drain field down?
Well, there's a difference between the groundwater and the water table.
Okay.
The water table can move up and down with how much precipitation we're getting.
Now, is that the water table that we drink, or is that the non-drinking?
No, the water you're drinking is from much deeper.
Okay.
Like, for instance, as I said, my well was 150 feet deep. So it takes years for that water to get back down to that point. But by the time it's down there, it's drinkable.
Okay.
Because everything's been filtered out of it.
So it could go to your 150 feet to your water table.
Right to your well. Now, the way they do that, they try to set these things up so that the water is not flowing from your drain field to your drinking well. So that's another little safety thing. But
there's a horizontal distance between.
Yeah, there's a minimal distance that you have to have between your septic tank and field and your water. And I think it's a minimum of 50 feet. So anyway, that's how it works. But if you don't pump it on a regular basis, and how often you pump it depends on how many people are in the house. So like a family of four, you should pump it about every 3 years. And if you don't, then the solid portion starts to go and clog up the holes in the drain field, and then the whole system stops working. Then you start getting your toilet backing up and things of that sort. You'll also see when a drain field is failing, it gets mushy on the surface and it smells like a septic tank.
And does organic material grow? Do plants grow there?
Oh, yeah.
Fertile?
The grass grows really well there.
So that's not a good sign when you're buying the house, which was the question that initiated
this
conversation.
If you're seeing a lot of growth over the septic field, then you might want to start asking some questions.
And you may want to in your offer for the house, you may want to reduce it by $20,000.
I would have somebody check it to find out what shape it's in.
Absolutely.
The health department will do that.
Very good. Well, folks, Gary has such a wealth of knowledge. He can talk on just about any subject. And we kind of got on an interesting subject about when you buy a house, things that can save you money. And you learned it here on the Good Growing with the Garden Show. And
the reason I kind of get into these things is because over the years, people have asked lots of questions about gardening over septic fields, what you can plant over septic fields, how they work, and you just learn these things over time.
Well, when we come back, I think there's a couple more things we want to follow up. This is Tom Majeure with Sue Majeure, and we'll be right back.
Do you want an easy way to support Strong Tar Radio and it won't cost you anything? If you shop Amazon, you can set up your account to have them donate to us. Just go to smile.amazon.com and pick Strong Tar Radio as your charitable organization, and they will donate 0.5% of the eligible purchase to us. That's smile.amazon.com. And you can do more to support Strong Tower Radio by going to strongtowerradio.org and hit the donate button and become a monthly covenant partner. Remember, every little bit helps. We should do all in our power to spread the three angels' messages of Revelation 14, 6 through 12.
Hello, folks. Welcome back to the second segment of Good Growing with the Garden Guy here on Strong Tower Radio. Welcome back, Gary.
Great to be back.
And my co-host, Sue Majeure.
Oh, yes. Always good to be here.
And Gary, we left with one question we started with is when you buy a new house, you can save lots of money with a couple tips that you were sharing. And one of them is, should you grow over your drain field? It may look so rich and everything is growing so good. Should we do this?
That would be a no.
No, that was a straightforward answer. And the question is, why?
You have to understand what's going on there. As we said, this is wastewater coming out of your septic tank.
Oh, you're saying like it might not be healthy?
Yeah.
Oh, like, yeah.
So, yeah, plants would grow very well there, but it would be a little risky. And you don't want anything in your drain field that could possibly clog up those holes, as I said before.
It's bad for more than one reason.
Yeah.
And it's no, no.
We generally tell people, leave the drain field alone. That's for the drain field. And there's always someplace else you can put the garden.
Very good. Thank you. Sue, you want to open up with a couple questions? Go to it.
Well, thinking about cover, I'm thinking about the cover crop. And I know, Tom, that you planted a cover crop in your greenhouse last fall. So, Gary, how long should the cover, what kind, how long should it stay there, and when do you turn it under for green fertilizer?
Well, about the only cover crops that would still be alive would be the Balboa rye, or if you planted a perennial cover crop like alfalfa or something like that, crown vetch. But we do not want a cover crop to go to seed. And how soon you cut it down will be determined on how you're going to deal with it. For instance, what I like to do is I use my rototiller to till a cover crop in. So I don't necessarily want the cover crop up to my waist. Now, what you could do is before something goes to seed, cut it down once and wait for it to dry and then till it in. And that drying process might take 2 or 3 weeks so that you could get the tines through it without it clogging up everything.
Wow, this is timely advice because I've had overwinter crop. That's timely advice because I have this overwinter crop and in my greenhouse and it's starting to grow. Mm-hmm. And so just hearing what you're saying, I need to mow it. I hadn't planned to get, we're recording this ahead of time. There's still snow on the ground, but not in my greenhouse. So I've got to cut this.
How tall is it?
Well, the last time I checked, I haven't been out there for a couple of weeks, but it's about 6 inches high.
Nothing to worry about right now. It'll start to grow like gangbusters late March, early April.
Okay.
And it's a rye, I assume, right?
It is correct.
Well, rye will grow once you get above 40 degrees, it's going to start to grow. And it's certainly going to get above 40 degrees in March in there because it'll... When we start getting nice, bright, sunny days, you'll probably get 60s, maybe even up to 70 sometimes. So it'll grow like crazy. But are you using a rototiller to do this?
I will be.
Yeah.
I have to. It's too much work.
Yeah. I don't want it to get waist high. Otherwise, it's going to be rough to deal with. And basically, the reason you have the cover crop in there is the rye will do two things. One, it increases the organic matter level in the soil, which we've talked a lot about organic matter already in March and part of this month. And also, you get what's called an allelopathic effect from rye.
That's a fancy word. What's that?
Yeah, that it's a fancy word for saying it keeps weed seeds from germinating at high levels.
Okay.
It actually discourages weed seed germination.
If I wanted to look this up, how do I spell it?
Oh, you gotta ask me that.
Sorry about that.
It's allelopathy.
Sue, do you remember the spelling tests?
and I think there's a double L in one of those L's, but I...
That's close enough. Google will find it for us.
Yeah, Google will do that for you. That's one of the great things. You could just be close.
Be close.
And they'll get it for you.
Okay, so it's the time of year that maybe you're planting in from seed inside, preparing to go put them in your garden later. So you kind of got that in train. But there might be some things that you can't get from seed or you don't have the time. And so you've ordered it. Mm-hmm. And hey, presto, your plants have arrived, but we have to go off to somebody's wedding.
Oh, no.
Or some other event. And I can't put it in the ground right now. What do I do?
Well, it depends on what it is. For the most part, I always tell people if you order something through the mail, open it up and check it out first. See what shape it's in. Because if it's not in good shape and it doesn't live, a lot of companies will have guarantees. And so keep your shipping containers. Sometimes you might even have to save the entire plant and send some of it back. But if it's dry, moisten it and keep it out of direct sunlight so it doesn't warm up. Depending on what it is, you can pot things up. You can go down to the Lowe's or some of those types of places and get some potting soil and put them in pots, and you can hold them for quite some time. You may still have to protect some things from frost, but fruit trees, even though they'll take a light frost, they don't do very well when they get a good freeze, so you may want to put those in the garage if there's a there's going to be a freeze that night. Otherwise, it'll kill the buds, and then it's going to weaken the plant quite a bit.
So what plants, you alluded to fruit trees, what other full plants would you be getting? I ordered asparagus once.
Blueberries, asparagus is one thing, but asparagus, the crowns are small enough, you can keep them in the refrigerator until you're ready to put them in the ground. Grapes, raspberries.
Yum, raspberries.
Yeah, they're pretty tough, so they can stay outside. Just put them up against the house if you're going to have some snow or something like that. But one of the things you can do so that you don't get caught off guard is when you order things, they will normally ask you, when do you want us to ship this? Otherwise, they'll ship it to you when they think it's right for your area, which is always too early. And so at least I've always experienced it's always been too early for me to be able to get out, because we may still have a lot of water in the soil. It's too wet to dig and those types of things. So if you tell them roughly when you want to get it, then you're more likely to not have to run into that kind of problem.
So let me kind of review those, kind of like on the cooking show. So when you order these plants, you open it up and check it out. See if they're good and healthy, and if they're not, respond immediately.
Respond immediately to the company. Tell them that they didn't look very good when they came in, and I'll keep you posted.
Okay. So even if you plan to keep them?
Yeah, I would.
Okay.
Now, I didn't follow my own advice.
Uh-oh.
Last year, I got a couple of fruit trees that came in, and I said, oh, that looks like fire blight. And they croaked right away, and they never really grew. And I didn't bother to contact them, but the guarantee is still good. But I have to send in a portion of the plant.
Okay.
In other words, like the bottom section or something. And I think that's to find out who really wants the refund.
There you go.
I haven't decided if I want to go through all that trouble or not. You know, I'm just so awash in money that I just don't need to do
it. Oh, yeah, sure, sure.
that is a joke.
That is a joke.
Are there some plants that are very, I don't know, roses seem to be one of those things where...
Didn't even think about roses.
You buy the, I guess they come bare root, or you can come...
They can come bare root, or they can come packaged with something packed around the roots.
So but are they kind of a fragile, finicky sort of a thing, unlike some of the tougher plants?
No, not really. They're fragile when you don't get good quality plants. And I always tell people you get what you pay for. So
should you get them a bare root, or should they be in some sort of media?
Either way could be fine. They can ship you a lot larger plant bare root for less money.
Right, because the shipper charges by weight.
Right, because if you have any kind of a packing material or soil or anything around the roots, that adds weight, that costs more, and you're paying for all of it no matter what you think. And they might say free shipping, but it's really not free.
Not free. That just on our ongoing definitions, bare roots means there's nothing but roots.
Basically, yeah. They might have a packing material like wet newspaper or sphagnum peat moss around it, but it's not like it's coming in a container with soil.
Very good. So that was point number one. Open it up and check out if there's a problem at the beginning. you moisten, do you moisten all of them, or are there some plants that you don't moisten?
You don't want to soak the roots. You just want to make sure they're moist, because roots that are dry die. It's that simple.
So how moist is moist? It's not standing in water?
No, you can just take a watering can and wet the packing material that's around them, and that's all you need to do. Get them out of direct sunlight, and they're fine.
Then how often should we check them? Do we put them into a plastic medium?
I'd wrap them back up in their original boxes or whatever packing material they had. Sometimes it's plastic. And then just check them every 2 or 3 days to see how they're doing.
So check, moisten and check every 2 or 3 days. Now, number three you mentioned was pod up. Does everything get podded up, or is just certain things get
podded up? Well, it depends on how long it's going to be before you're going to be able to put them in the ground. If, for instance, I'm going to be able to put something within the ground in about a week, then I won't bother potting it up. I'll just store
it. Unnecessary step.
If it's something that I know I'm not going to get to it for a month, then I'll put it in a pot, because as it warms up, it can start to grow. And when it starts to grow, it starts to produce new roots. And those new roots are going to help that plant to survive.
Hmm. You kind of want to keep, do you want to keep those under, do you want those things to grow or not to grow while you, before you get them into the final planting?
Well, once they break bud and they start to grow, you need to do something with them.
Okay.
So if you can't put them in the ground, then put them in pots.
Does the break budding, how soon does that happen after the new root?
That root all growth? Depends on our weather. Say, for instance, you know how Michigan can be, you can have 30, 30, 30, 30, and all of a sudden it goes up to 60.
Yeah.
And you get a few days of 60 degrees and buds start to swell up and grow.
So do roots and buds come simultaneous, or is there a little drag, or is
actually the roots
specific?
Actually, the roots start a little sooner.
Week, 2 weeks?
Maybe a week or two.
Okay, good. And then... I saw something about ship date here.
Oh, yeah, the ship date is when you tell them when you want it shipped so that you don't get caught unprepared.
Very good. So open them up, moisten them up, pot them up if necessary if you're going to be a period of time, and that ship date might be a little sooner than you're ready.
Okay, here's a good question that Tom really, really wants to know the answer to.
I do?
Yes, you do. Okay. You've wanted to know it for years.
Of course. I just can't wait to know what I'm supposed to want to know.
When to prune that flowering tree or shrub?
Oh, yes. Gary actually came over and helped me out on that, but it's always good to have a refresher every year.
Well, right now we're talking about ornamentals, but fruit trees are a little bit different. It really depends on what your goal is and also what type of plant it is. For instance, in our area, anything that blooms up till about mid-June has its flower buds in place right now. They started producing last summer and fall. Anything that blooms after around mid-June, it will produce the flower buds on this current season. So that makes a difference. If you're trying to prune to preserve your flowers, then anything that's going to be spring flowering, you wait until after it flowers.
No more fall pruning, Tom.
Now, there's nothing wrong with doing pruning in the spring on a spring flowering plant, as long as you realize that you're giving up flowers. And if you have a plant, for instance, that's been neglected for many years, you might elect to do that, a really huge lilac, for instance.
So you're talking about ornamental flowering trees,
right?
Not fruit trees,
right?
Okay.
And so, for instance, if you had Rosa Sharon, which is a summer flowering plant, you could prune that now without having any effect on the flowering, because it won't produce flowers until it produces new growth. So that's the first rule of thumb. Now, fruit trees are a little different.
Now, lilac was in the previous category. That's
a spring flowering plant. And if you don't want to lose flowers, then wait until after it blooms.
I always have to tease Tom a little, because the fall, he would be like looking at this is all messy, this plant poking out here. I have to clean this all up. I don't have time to do it in the spring. Chop, 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 chop. Then I'd come out, and in the spring he'd say, boy, this thing sure doesn't have any flowers. I'm like, yeah, because you chopped them all off in the fall.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I was always after him, wait until after they bloomed and then chop away.
Yeah, Tom, you should listen to her.
Yes, I understand.
Now, fruit trees, we do something a little different. They require an annual pruning, and they all have their flower buds in place right now. So when you prune them, you're going to be pruning off some flower buds, but that's okay because that's one of the major ways that you thin your fruit is by taking off excess wood. But if we don't annually prune fruit trees, they will get to the point to where they'll become less productive because of the way the tree will start to grow. It'll start to have an umbrella shape at the top, and the lower branches will be shaded, and those branches won't produce flower buds at all, and they'll eventually die. And then your tree is very unproductive because the only fruit you're going to get is way up at the top.
Does that apply to the ornamental fruit trees, like, say, crab apples?
The same thing will happen. We just don't prune them as seriously because we're primarily interested in flowers and not fruit. So it's a less drastic pruning that we do on flowering trees like crab apples.
Let's go back to the garden and vegetable garden, and what do we need to prepare and what fertilizing do we do in April?
Well, hopefully you will do a soil test first, because otherwise when you put fertilizer down, you have no idea what's there already. And when you're applying things that you don't need, you're wasting your money.
Mm-hmm.
Plus the fact, if you're putting down too much fertilizer, you can actually cause other problems. But that's when you really get excessive. Now, if somebody wants to do a soil test here in Michigan, we have a soil testing kit that you can order from MSU that will explain everything. And you get your results from an email, and then there's a website that you go to that'll help you to tell you what you need to do. If you're not familiar with soil testing at all, you might need some help and you might have to call your local extension office. But that's the first thing you want to do.
And remind us how we get that kit.
You can go to the MSU bookstore online, Michigan State University bookstore, and there's a search box and just go to soil testing. Although a lot of times in the spring, they'll highlight that on the opening page. And it's pretty much self-explanatory.
There's extension offices in just about every county.
Right, yeah.
Can you also get them there?
You might want to call your local county. Some may carry it and others may not. It depends on how much they want to keep around the office.
Kind of reminds me, it's like ask your grocer. So maybe if we all ask for it, they'll start, some of our agencies, extensions might start stocking it for us.
A lot of offices used to keep bulletins and soil testing kits and all those sorts of things, but it costs money to keep all that stuff. So, and then things go out of date. So it's been more of a trend to order it directly from the MSU bookstore.
Now, does it come in the mail?
Yes, it's okay. Mailed to you.
Okay, very good.
Are there any like graphs or things that you could say Google online that would say when you're starting to plan your vegetable garden, don't plant your peppers next to the tomatoes, or don't plant your cauliflower next to your raspberries or whatever?
There are lots of ideas that people have on different things. What I like to suggest to people is try to put things together that require similar cultural requirements.
Nutrition.
For instance, I think about pest control. I know anything in the cabbage family is going to have to be dealt with in terms of that imported cabbage worm that we talked about and some of the other related things. So I try to put those all together, and I just have to spray that area with the particular pesticides that I need there. And that way I'm not spraying over here, going over somewhere else to spray. I try to concentrate things where I need to. There are some examples of planting things where if you had a plant that was a heavy feeder like corn or tomatoes one year, you come back in with something that's a light feeder like lettuce or carrots or something the next year. And that way you're not depleting that area as quickly. And you also have to think that a lettuce plant can only get nutrients in about the top 6 to 7 inches of the soil. But a tomato can go down 4 or 5 feet and out many feet. So they can really search for the nutrients. And so it's always nice to put something that can get nutrients down deeper, from down deeper, where something was very shallow before. And then you get better use of the nutrients that are there. Also, when you're putting nutrients in, you can we talked about adding compost, and compost is a very beneficial thing. And I think I've mentioned this before. I try not to waste any organic matter, and I have worms that are composting for me right now when I can't go outside. And I will take all that worm compost and dump it into the garden in the spring. In this case, it'll be raised beds because we're going to make some raised beds. And that improves the soil fertility and the overall soil health. So if you've been composting in the fall, then you bring this in the spring and then till it in.
People do have worm farms, you know, and they get the castings or the little poop that they put out that has all the nutrients. Mm-hmm. But you can buy worm castings like online, can't you?
You can, but it's much cheaper to do your own. They're quiet. They don't cause any trouble.
Easy maintenance.
They just do their thing down in the basement.
Well, folks, on worm casting, we're going to close out segment two and go to segment three. This is Good Growing with the Garden Guy with Gary Heilig, Sue Majeure, and Tom Majeure. We will be right back.
Hello friends, this is Doug Batchelor from Amazing Facts. Strong Tower Radio is a station that believes in the power of prayer. In the book Steps to Christ, we're told, prayer is the opening of the heart to God as to a friend. Not that it's necessary in order to make known to God what we are, but in order to enable us to receive Him. Prayer does not bring God down to us, but brings us up to Him. What a beautiful promise of God's power for our lives. Do you have a special prayer request that you'd like for us to pray for? If so, call us at 877-278-5512 or send an email through our website, strongtowerradio.org. We have a team of prayer warriors standing by to join with you in taking your petitions to the throne of grace. God loves each of us so much, and He's waiting to hear from you.
Hello, folks. Welcome back to Good Growing with the Garden Guy, Gary Heilig. Welcome back, Gary.
I'm still here.
Still here. All three segments. And my co-host, Sue Majeure.
Still curious.
All right. You are always curious. And thanks. We're so glad you're curious because you have great questions. Sue, when we left off on our last segment, we were talking about worm farming. So throw that out again.
Okay. I understand that it's really such a high quality way of getting nutrients for your garden, and they're undemanding and so on, but you can do your own one, but you can get one like kits online, can't you, that has a setup?
You can. It's a way for people to make money.
really, you.
down in my basement, what I basically did is I went to one of the big box hardware stores, and I put some shredded newspaper in there or shredded office paper. If you're using office paper, it should be soaked so you get the chemicals out. But I stopped using office paper because the compost came out gray. Mm-hmm. And I said, no. And so what I started doing is taking all the potting soil that I used during the summer for things on the deck and the front porch. And I would put that soil in a container and take it down to the basement. And I used that as the bed. And the bedding for the worms. And the red worms would eat the kitchen waste, like when we would eat an apple and if somebody peeled it. Most of the time I don't peel them, but potato peels and banana peels and things like that.
Or seeds and stuff.
Yeah, and the worms will basically break all that material down, and then I can take that and put it in the pots again, or I can put it in the garden, and it improves the soil over time. And instead of sending all this stuff to the landfill, this organic matter stays on my property.
Now, do you have a like a filtering system? I guess some of them do, where the castings come down.
Well, basically, some of those that have a filtering system, castings will fall down as they dry out, but a lot of times they will have a little spigot for the liquid to be drawn off. And I had some of those when I was working. My secretaries made me get rid of it.
When? Why?
Well, the major reason why is you will always have a certain amount of mortality of worms in these things. And dying worms don't smell good. So
you keep them in your basement at home?
Oh, I do, but they're in completely enclosed containers. This wasn't that system that you were thinking about where it has the little filters and things. That wasn't very friendly to the worms. And
oh, really?
I had a higher level of death than mortality. I do just having them in a plastic container.
So let me just let's picture this for it. So you went to the big box hardware store or any place, and were you buying 5-gallon pails?
I have different sizes. I tried different sizes.
What's your ideal size?
The largest one I have was about 3 feet by 2 feet.
And what are these? Are these like...
They're plastic containers.
Just like a Rubbermaid type?
Just storage containers, yeah. Now, the problem is when you get one that large is as you keep adding organic matter, they get very heavy. But I just load it up on my wagon and haul it out to the garden. So it's just lifting it up and putting it in the wagon. But you can get as small as one as you want. But you have to remember how much stuff you have that you want to put in there. I try not to waste a lot of food material.
Okay.
But there's certain things that are just going to be wasted when you are making, a salad and there's some lettuce that's wilted or something like that.
Or you have a pineapple. Keep the top of the pineapple or put it into the compost?
I don't always do that, but during the summer I do. I don't usually feed that to the worms, but I could. During the summer I put it in a tumbler out behind the garage.
Now, so we've got this container. Do you keep the top of this storage container?
The top is still on it, yeah.
So after you do whatever you do, you fill it up and you throw your worms in there and stuff, it's completely sealed, or do you leave it askew so a little bit of air gets to it?
It's sealed, but I will go down there every now and then, open the top, because worms don't use a lot of oxygen, and... Or you can make little pinholes in the top if you want for gas exchange. I would not make very large holes because in a basement, centipedes could get in there and they will eat the worms.
Oh, that's not good.
No.
So how do you, how often and how do you harvest?
The compost?
Yeah.
Usually I will let it run. Say if I start it in the fall, I'll let it run till the next spring and then take it out. Let it run for years if you have a very large container. And what I'm thinking of doing, I have one that's, as I said, 3 by 2 and about 2 feet high. I have another one that's about 2 feet by not quite 3 feet, and it's a real hard plastic. Then I have one that's in a 55-gallon garbage can.
Okay.
And you can run that for maybe 3 years before you'd have to dump it.
So that's standing vertically.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So are you harvesting it off the top or the bottom?
Yeah, I usually will harvest it. I'll dig down. I'll move the material over, and I'll dig down to the bottom because that's usually the most decomposed material.
And so, leaving the worms there.
Yeah, well, sometimes worms will come with you. But the way you can get rid of the worms, I have a little desk lamp, and I'll take the compost, and then I'll pile it on the say some aluminum foil or some plastic or something, and then I'll put the light really close to it.
Mm-hmm.
And worms like to be in dark and cool, so it drives them down to the bottom.
Okay.
And then I'll just take the compost off the top. And then when I get down to the bottom where there's a bunch of worms, I just take the worms and throw them back in the container.
Okay, so I'm still trying to visualize this for myself and for the audience. So you start out with this container. A plastic container. You take some of your old potting soil. Where do you get these worms from?
You can buy them, or if, like Master Gardeners, many times will have some. You find that they'll have extra. All you need is a handful.
So you know your friend who's a Master Gardener.
A Master Gardener, somebody that has one. You can buy them.
At a bait shop.
I would buy them through garden catalogs. They have the red wigglers. You might find some at a bait shop, but they have to be the red wigglers. It's a certain type of red worm.
Not the leaf worms or the night crawlers.
No. A red wiggler shouldn't be in a bait shop because fish don't like those.
Okay.
What happens is they excrete this little white material and fish will just spit them right out.
Okay.
So I don't know why anybody would want to sell red wigglers in a bait shop.
But then again, Sue, maybe I would want red wigglers, wouldn't I? Because I hate taking fish off hooks.
Well,
this is true.
You may never get him on the hook.
Well, I just out there to be for the social. But anyway, let's get back to this. So we take old potting soil, or you could take other medium that you mentioned, newspaper and so on and so forth.
Newspaper works better than office paper, though.
Right. So do you do 100% office paper, or do you put some, a little bit of soil to just kind of space
it? You can mix them up.
Could be 100% office.
I have done 100% office paper, and that's when you get the really great compost.
Right. But 100% newspaper, I'm sorry.
Yeah, you can. Yeah.
And so if
you're going to use newspaper, though, you should rip it along the grain.
Really?
Real thin strips, yeah. Don't just throw newspaper in there.
So you find which way it. I know there's a grain to paper, but you.
The long way is the grain.
The way that's. So I have two sheets of paper there. I go the whole length horizontally?
Yeah, you fold it in half and then just pull it. Just tear it. It tears very easily. You'll know which way the grain is very easily.
Okay, so you learned that here.
And then you have a little moisture, and then you got to put in the tasty peelings and things for them to eat.
Right, but when you're first starting, you don't want to give it too much because the worms can only eat so much.
Really?
You want their numbers to build up.
Okay, so let's say I'm just guessing, I'm doing a storage container that's pretty standard, and so I'm about 2 feet wide and about 3 feet long, just roughly, and about 18 inches deep. I rip up my newspaper the long way, I moistened it, don't want any standing water.
Right.
And I throw just a little bit of organic material, waste, kitchen waste, and how many worms?
As many as you can get your hands on. You normally get about 2 pounds.
2 pounds.
When you order them.
And I order these online?
Yeah, you can order them online.
Can I get them?
I wouldn't be surprised if you can get them from Amazon.
Yeah. Well, of course. But what about, are there any garden shops? You probably wouldn't get this at the big box.
No, they don't sell worms. That's something you're going to have to order.
So you call and say, I need some worms by the pound.
Hey, I can bring you some worms, Tom.
Okay, please do. I can't wait till you come back. I'll probably be in Lansing sometime in the near future.
Brenda will love that. No more compost in the kitchen.
That's right. Well, we actually walk out to a compost pile, which is a long ways away.
Well, and this is a nice alternative during the winter months.
Yes, we know about that.
Because there's nothing going on in your compost pile, at least not very fast.
It's stagnant out there in the cold,
right.
Rigid.
But the worms can be very active. And once you have a box, say 3x2x1, that can handle about 7 pounds of food waste a week.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Guess what I'm going to be doing this week?
Brenda will love that.
That's right. Amen. Praise the Lord.
Now, ideally, you want to try to not produce the food waste to begin with, but
use most of it to be consumed.
Yeah, you have to be careful too. We're talking about basically vegetable waste.
Correct.
I would not put prepared foods in there. Because when you have oils and spices and different things, then you start to get some unsavory smells. Those things can be composted, but it should be what we call pit composting, which is you dig a pit and put it in there and cover it up.
Meat, no dairy.
No, nothing like no meat, no dairy,
and
no fat.
And we actually talked about this in a previous program about a year ago. But let me just ask you a question about this, is that if I have my frozen vegetables that I, let's say, I didn't get my green bean crop. I can put those into this system, this farm.
Mm-hmm.
If I had a mix that had savory, you know, it was some sort of Italian whatever, that's still okay as long as it doesn't have oil content.
You're fine. Yeah,
okay, good.
Fine.
Well, you know what? In our last little bit of segment, we'll want to talk about our gardens and our lawns. So we have about 7 minutes to talk about lawns and gardens.
Okay.
What should we be doing this month?
Well, in April, things are starting to grow in the lawn, and crabgrass is going to start to germinate about the same time that forsythia blooms, which is that bush that produces the yellow flowers before the leaves come out.
Mm-hmm.
And also when the soil temperature reaches about 50 degrees. So if you're going to try to control crabgrass with a pre-emergence material, and there are products that are organic that you can use, like Concern. It's a corn gluten meal, and it will prevent crabgrass germination. That's the time to put it down.
And is that readily available everywhere?
Yeah, Concern is easy to find.
Okay.
And there are other products, like, for instance, if you were on the Scott system where you're using Scott Step 1, it has a product in it called pendimethalin, and that also is a pre-emergence material to prevent crabgrass. But what I also like to tell people is crabgrass comes into your lawn when the lawn is weak and there's a lot of open space for those seeds to germinate. So you may want to have a little bit more aggressive fertilization program to thicken up that turf. Also in April, you can overseed, and you can buy an overseeder that'll put the seed right in the ground. And
that's a good thing, overseeding, right?
Yes, because like I said, if you don't want weeds, you need thick grass, because a lawn is not a natural thing in nature. You don't normally see what we call monocultures of just one type of plant. So you have to put...
So a lawn is basically one type of plant, even though in a lawn you probably have a couple different types of grasses, but they're all grasses.
They're all grasses. But if you were to just do absolutely nothing to your lawn, it would become more diverse as different plants would start to move in. Some wildflowers, a lot of them are what we would consider weeds, but that's what would happen if you just allow nature to do its thing. So what you need to do is thicken up that grass so that there's not a lot of space for weeds to get in there and grow. And once you've done the overseeding, around Memorial Day, you start your fertilization program.
So overseeding with grass seed now and doing fertilization in June.
Do you know, should you have your lawn tested to know how much fertilization so you don't burn it with over-fertilizing?
Well, you're highly unlikely to burn it as a result of not soil testing. You're most likely going to burn your lawn if you're using a very highly concentrated source of nitrogen like urea, which is 45%, 46% nitrogen. And if you were to put too much of that on, then you will burn your lawn. So without soil testing, you're not likely to burn your lawn. But what it does tell you is how much phosphorus, if any, you need. And it also will tell you how much potassium you need. And the amount of nitrogen is based on your management program that you've chosen.
Let's talk about what we can do with our garden. What should we be doing with our garden?
Well, in April, you can start putting out some of the cool season crops.
Cool season crops?
Like broccoli, cabbage, cauliflower. Well, cauliflower is usually planted more late in the season, but you could plant it in the spring. Onions are usually put in. You certainly would have peas in by that time, radishes. Those are the type of things that will put up with a light frost and will grow just fine under the cooler conditions. Potatoes is another one. Now, assuming you can get into your garden in April, if you have a lighter textured soil, you might be able to do that. Me, I usually can't get until mid to late May.
Wow. Well, folks, this almost does it for this month's edition of Good Growing with the Garden Guy. Gary, would you give us your YouTube address one more time?
It's Get Growing with Gary, and my name could also be used to search it. It's Gary Heilig, H-E-I-L-I-G. And if you have any topics you'd like to see me do a video on, just leave a comment, and I will eventually see it and try to do that.
And folks, I want you to take advantage of it. There is over 100 videos up on that YouTube channel at this time. Well, I want to thank you again, Gary, for being a part of the Good Growing Show. It's been over a year, and I've enjoyed every moment of it.
I enjoy coming.
And Sue, I appreciate this. This is our fourth Good Growing program, and I think there'll be many more.
Yes, I learn something every time.
Bye, folks. Have a wonderful week. Bye now.